Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been a few months since I've had some State House reporters on deck. Today, it's Bill Cohen from Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy, glad you're here.
Thank you.
And Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press.
Good morning.
Good morning, Julie. The only thing to start talking about right off the bat, because that's what I talked about at the top of the hour, was the budget, or should I say the budget deficit, the looming budget deficit. What is it? What are we looking at? Julie?
Well, the problem is we have a budget in place, but we balanced it in these precarious ways. And so what's happening is every month, let's say, when the economic advisors come in and tell the governor how things are going, it's just sort of a nail-biting kind of situation. Are the taxes coming in as they're supposed to? And they're a little bit ahead of projections at times in some areas, but it's still a big worry.
I think the big problem, of course, is the federal stimulus money that's in the budget.
And the one-time only money.
The one-time only money. And there's estimates that we're looking at anywhere from a $5 to $9 billion shortfall. And that's significant considering the entire budget's $52 billion.
Yeah.
And of course, you say, is it one-time money or not? Now,
right.
Ted Strickland is hoping it's not one-time money, and in some miracle finish here, the feds are going to say, there's so many states that have budget deficits again. Okay, we're going to, send them several billion dollars again. But,
but
there's no guarantee.
What's the timing on that? When might we find out?
Well, it's maybe in bits and pieces. I mentioned that Medicaid, in the jobs bill that was just passed by Congress, included an extension of the extra funds the federal government provides for state Medicaid programs. That now is going to continue. Instead of going just through December this year, it's going to go through June 30th of 2011. So what you might see is stimulus being extended for certain programs at certain times. It may not all come as one big stimulus bill, but it may come, here's education, an extension of stimulus money for education. We're certainly seeing things like extensions of federal assistance on jobs benefits. Those things are coming. So it may kind of be more of a trickle here and there.
But, this sounds kind of boring on the surface, but it's going to impact every Ohioan because if we have a $5 to $9 billion hole, even if we get $2 or $3 or $4 billion from the feds, that still leaves a multi-billion dollar hole. And the question is, how do you fill it? Do you cut mental health programs again? Do you cut welfare payments? Do you cut environmental programs? Or do you raise taxes? Or do you do a combination of both?
Or do you release people from prison? I mean, there are many impacts that can be a factor. And I think the other thing about the stimulus is that this idea that it actually might work. And so I think in Washington, with everything going as things are, there's an idea, let's wait as much as we can to see, as I say, with these tax projections coming in and to see how that works so that we have to fill the least amount possible. And
this budget comes due, though, is that July 1st? Is it that or is it the following?
It's June 30th, 2011 is the end of the budget cycle.
Okay. And but a year isn't a lot of time. And they already put together a study group, didn't they? And it never has even met, like 6 or 8 or 9 months ago, something like that?
Yeah, they didn't even get together at all. So it shows sort of the bipartisan impasse that we have here, which is mimicking sort of what's going on in Washington.
Politically, it's very difficult to get anything done. I mean, there was really interesting stories about in the last week about that committee they appointed to look at the budget. Mm-hmm. And here we are 7 or 8 months into the budget and the committee's never met. We have a similar, and I've talked to your listeners about this before, on the unemployment compensation fund. We've been borrowing from the federal government for more than a year. We have an advisory council that hasn't met in months. There's just not a lot happening in state government in terms of solutions.
Remember that 4.2% income tax cut that we were supposed to get last year, but they decided to delay for 2 years because we had such a big budget hole. Okay, so I'm putting the word supposed in quotes. We're supposed to finally get that 4.2% income tax cut. when the new budget happens in mid
2011. So it should include that decrease in revenues.
Yeah, but if we have a $4, $5, or $9 billion hole, I think most people now at the state are saying you can kiss that goodbye. That's not just a 2-year delay. That's going to be a 4-year delay or a 6-year delay, or you're never going to get that last 4.2% cut in the state income tax. So again, just another example of how this really is going to affect people's wallets.
And Republicans and Democrats both would want to avoid a tax increase at all costs.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, I would say the Democratic governor does and has been on board with that. I don't know that all Democrats are opposed to tax increases. But politically speaking, it can't happen in an election year.
Yeah, I mean, you even have some liberal Democrats have even proposed in the last year, let's add another bracket to the state income tax and hit people above $500,000 a year. I think right now it's $200,000 or $250,000 is the top bracket. They say, well, let's get the super rich with them, you know, hit them even harder. But, of course, that's a minority in the legislature right now.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Bill Cohen from Ohio Public Radio and also Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch and Julie Carr-Smyth from the Associated Press. We're talking about all things state house and politics and all kinds of fun stuff, including the budget, which is I don't know if it's depressing or not anymore. It just seems to be this constant pressure. And it's always there looming, and nothing's getting done on it. The study committee has not gotten together. But that's just another example of how everything in the state house seems to be, as I like to use the word, languishing.
I agree. I mean, how many bills have been passed?
What's the count now?
Gosh, I don't know the latest count, but it's not more than really a couple dozen, or I mean, it's really low.
Well, you know, if you don't have any excess cash, then that nixes any proposal that's going to cost some extra money. So about the only kind of bills that you do have that have a chance of passing are things that kind of are just tinkering or that maybe, you know, are going to add some efficiency to government, might save some money. Mm-hmm. But if you come up with a proposal that's going to cost some money, forget it. That's not going anywhere right now.
Right. And the social issues always rear their heads when there's no money, you know. Human cloning, marijuana, medical marijuana, these other things that they think, well, this will make a big splash and get me a headline, but yet it's not necessarily going to cost any money.
And it's not necessarily going to go anywhere either. They can introduce it in one chamber, and which has been the issue. It's not as though they haven't introduced a gazillion bills. It's just that they haven't passed to the other chamber and gotten the action they need to become enacted into law.
Yeah, well, when you have one chamber controlled by Democrats and the other controlled by Republicans, and you got an election year, you're not going to get a whole lot of cooperation.
Not going to be much going on.
There are a few things, though. But before I get to those, I wanted to talk about the idea of eliminating the income tax in Ohio how that's progressing in the legislature these days, Bill?
Well, it's kind of in fits and starts. It's been introduced by a handful of conservative Republicans who are in the minority in the Ohio House. And usually the Democrats who control the chamber would just say, well, forget it. We hate that proposal. We're not giving it any hearings. But interestingly, this year they've kind of done a 180. They've said, you know, we're going to give this bill hearings. But that's because we're going to bring in all these people who are going to testify what a terrible idea would be to get rid of the state income tax. And then we're going to use that against the Republican candidate for governor, John Kasich, because in general, he also wants to wipe out the state income tax over 10 years or whatever, some kind of long time period, he says, phase it out. So they're trying to use this politically against him. And they did hold a hearing a couple weeks ago, which was just fascinating because – you know, usually you'd think there'd be the proponents would at least get, you know, a few people to testify, and then we'd hear the opponents. Well, this hearing, the Democrats staged the hearing, and they had 6 opponents testify, and they didn't let any proponents testify.
Is it just tradition that you have proponents testify first, or did they have the bill sponsor testify, and then
testify, but this was kind of the first hearing where you're really going to have real people testify, and you'd think common sense – whether you're for or against the bill, you know, set that aside. Common sense would say, well, at least you have some people say why it's a good idea, and then you can have some people on picking it apart. But they just had 6 people picking it apart, and even somebody came in from Washington who wanted to speak for the bill. Time ran out. He had to go home.
And I was going to say it wasn't just leaving it to chance who might walk into that chamber. I mean, there were some powerful interest groups that were trying to get their message out, the teachers. And I'm trying to think of some of the others that came. But I know, like, the teacher unions brought in people to talk about schools and how it would impact them not to have that 40% of our revenue coming in.
Was this one of those packed hearing room situations?
It was pretty packed. Yeah, there was, you know, city officials there because they don't want to see the income tax disappear because they depend on that flowing through to them. Mm-hmm. And school officials and social welfare advocates. And if they ever do have another hearing on it, I assume we're going to hear even more opponents to it.
The problem with this is a bill by Representative John Adams, and the problem that we're having in terms of translating that to the governor's race is that, as Bill said, John Kasich sort of has supported the idea, but he hasn't given any specifics. And so I think the Democrats leaped on this as sort of, here's a chance to talk about real-world consequences of what this concept is. But Kasich continues to reject the idea that he has put any time frame on it, which he sees as, you know, well, we just have to wait and see. And that makes it difficult for us as reporters to explain what is that going to mean and where does he stand.
Don't you think he's kind of backed away from it, though? I mean, I can recall previously him talking about it. I always thought that was something he advocated for. But I know this year when people have pressed him for details about his plan, now I'm hearing more about time frame and if – we'll see.
I was on the air one day, and I was referring to him as endorsing. Took too much liberty with that word. What I meant was endorsing the idea of an income tax cut, and I stand behind that. But then I think I got a call from Doug Price from the Franklin County Republicans saying, "Wait a minute, he hasn't endorsed that bill at all. That's not accurate." And well, okay.
Endorsed the concept. When he announced for governor several months ago, that was his number one proposal. It was the most down to earth, bread and butter, fundamental change that symbolized what he's about, which is, he says, smaller government, lower taxes.
Well, and he actually did go to John Adams' district pre announcing his campaign and spoke about how John Adams knows his way around this issue, and John Adams is right on taxes. And this was at a point when the bill was already introduced and analyzed in the legislature. So I think Kathy's right that he's backing off it because it's getting attached to some negative consequences.
We have to take a quick break. We'll return in a few minutes with Bill Cohen, Kathy Kandisky, and Julie Carr-Smythe. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you think about an income tax? What do you think about eliminating the income tax in Ohio, not just an income tax decrease? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
The vision and restoration efforts of people in the Short North have preserved an important slice of Columbus history.
People sometimes in Columbus don't realize how lucky we are. The Short North is really a gem. It's something very special.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 46 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 55. Clear skies tonight, a low of 35 degrees, sunny tomorrow and a high of 60.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about all things political and public policy-wise at the statehouse level. My guests are Kathy Kandisky, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and also Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press, and Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Let's just go right into the governor's race. We were talking about the fact that John Kasich has not really talked publicly much about not just the idea of an income tax cut or elimination lately, but really almost anything, at least directly to reporters.
Right. And I, in my experience, it's pretty unusual that if you're writing a story on a particular specific topic and you're trying to pin down the points of view of the candidates, that the candidates wouldn't get on the phone with you. I'm just sort of baffled by it. It feels a little bit like waiting to see if you say something that they don't agree with and then coming out with a statement that the press is against them. And, you know, that's a frustration when you're trying to do an accurate and thorough job on something.
But you see him on Facebook all the time.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think the candidates now more than ever, maybe because of the technology you mentioned.
The social media.
Social media mm-hmm. are trying to take their message directly to the public and avoiding the media. They're posting. Avoiding any kind of dialogue.
Pushback.
Exactly.
All. Yeah.
You post a statement on YouTube. And you can put out what you want to put out with nobody asking you any question. And then they hear it, you know, unfiltered. The public hears it unfiltered. I think this is very appealing. I think you're seeing it more and more from the candidates, several.
Just to be fair, we did do a half-hour program with Kasich, mm-hmm. Karen Kassler, our bureau chief, and me. We got a half-hour with him and used it on Karen's public TV show, The State of Ohio, and we took some excerpts and put it on public radio reports. And that was a couple weeks ago. And, you know, we asked tough questions, and he didn't give a whole lot of answers, but he's very good at making his general points, but maybe without at this point giving specifics. So I just wanted to be fair to show that. I mean, yeah. He is giving some interviews, and I don't know why they would be hesitant to let him spar with reporters, because I think he does an excellent job. There was mm-hmm. a gaggle of reporters outside the Farm Bureau a couple weeks ago, and he sat there or stood there for 20 minutes answering questions and, you know, at some points danced around issues, but did a great job, I thought, of making his basic points while at the same time doing what he wanted to do, which was avoiding answering some tough
but,
questions.
But, you know, also to be fair, not saying much at this point in the game is not unusual anyway.
No.
I think Strickland didn't really say much until May. Of the year that when he was running for governor the last time. So
whoever thinks they have the momentum and is ahead, they say, why should I stick my foot in my mouth? I'm just going to – for instance, Kasich is basically saying, I think, or his advisors are saying, look, the economy is going terribly. As long as it's going terribly, I'm doing pretty darn good in the polls, even though people don't even know who I am. The Polish show Kasich is not well known. So why should I come up with any specifics here? I'll let the economy do the job on Strickland.
Right. And I think that they are right now focusing on talking to their constituents, raising money, building their grassroots structure, and trying to get all that stuff in place for the election.
Right. Kasich's been in 83 counties now, I guess.
And the focus on making that personal connection with individuals through Facebook, through Twitter. I think the candidates get a lot of good out of that. And mm-hmm. Kasich's really doing well with it. You notice him a lot more than, say, you do the Strickland.
I agree. I wasn't sure whether I was missing something, but that would be my impression as well. There's a lot different. There's a lot more focus on social media with the Strickland campaign, the Kasich campaign.
And, you know, he can be very kind of, one-sided conversation, but he'll weigh in on sporting events.
Yes, he will.
On different things like that. Now, sometimes that can backfire. But,
I don't care about it, but I guess someone must. They must be reading some numbers out there somewhere that people care about it.
And that'll be interesting, as always, with, you know, the young people and in addition to those of us who aren't young. I think that
present company excluded.
But, you know, I think with just everybody having their PDA and watching what Twitter posts are going on and retweeting and all that stuff, that is a really interesting thing. We saw in the Jennifer Bruner campaign just this week. I mean, they're starting to put out just little endorsements from people via these networks, and you know, of course, they have zero money. So that's an interesting technique.
If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's see what Mike has to say. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I really don't think that there's anybody running for governor that's representing the middle class. It's my opinion, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think this country has become more of a fascist country than a democracy. You know, fascism is when corporations basically have control, and the only people who seem to we get a vote for are the people that corporations endorse and give money to. And this country was its strongest when the middle class was the power, the buying power. They're what turned the economy. Today's economy is basically you have 5% of the people in this country receive 95% of every dollar that's earned. 5%. The other 95% of us, we get the 5% that's left. We have to address some governor or somebody, some president somewhere is going to have to run on the fact that the middle class has to become the power again, and the rich and the elite and the corporations have got to stop being the ones who are telling us who we're going to vote for.
Well, you must have been a little distressed by that U.S. Supreme Court decision recently then.
And we're headed towards fascism if we're not already there, simply because they're supporting the corporations rather than the people. And fascism is corporations,
okay,
not people.
I can see why you might not be enamored with Strickland or Kasich, but you know, I think there is a Green Party candidate who's going to probably be on the ballot who might agree with a lot of what you just said, the anti-corporation kind of viewpoint. So you might take a look at some of those minority parties that may have their name on the ballot, because you may have your choice of not just two candidates but several.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't have the list with me, but I believe socialist and libertarian also. So it's part of this sort of Tea Party grassroots energy that is bringing out some candidates in some different parties with some different viewpoints.
Well, the only thing is that it doesn't matter who these people are. 90% of the people don't hear who they are because most of the information is bought and paid for on TV. I would imagine that probably radio and TV's income runs on a cycle right along with the elections, because I would guess that probably 75% of their income comes from political ads.
Not public radio. Go on.
No, public radio was great. Public radio was the best when it didn't need support from the people it was paid for with tax dollars.
I will say, I don't think candidate Kasich would agree with you on that.
No, I'm sure he wouldn't, because the problem is all these politicians want to control the information that goes out about them. And, you know, I would just love to see open discussions like we had with the president and the congressmen or the senators when they discussed that. I mean, I'm one of the few people probably who watched the whole 6 or 8 hours of it and was riveted by it. I just wish that we were more involved in our—
You mean during the healthcare
yes,
summit?
During the healthcare summit.
All right.
That was fantastic. That's what we need more of.
Okay.
And hear from these green parties and these libertarians and everything. But as it is right now, we've got two parties— Democrat and Republican, and there really isn't a good representation of the other people.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, you might want to become a journalist. You'll get to sit through a lot of meetings like that.
You know, one thing, I just want to add one thing here. We often hear this, you know, that people calling in or just commenting or friends or relatives saying, you know, the American people are fed up with the two major parties. And we hear this every four mm-hmm. years. They're fed up with the two major parties. Well, if they really are, there are plenty of other candidates on the ballot. The libertarians almost always have a presidential candidate on the ballot.
Yeah.
The Constitutional Party mm-hmm. on the far right, the Green Party on the left, the Socialists on the left. I mean, there are choices, and every year, you know, the critics say, oh, you know, people are fed up. Well, the people apparently aren't fed up enough to vote for these other minor parties, because they only get 1 or 2% every time. It's a fact of life.
He speaks to a growing frustration, though, and mm-hmm. and I think you're seeing it. I've been kind of interested watching the Tea Party folks and like-minded groups, you know, getting involved in these races. I mean, I have no idea how significant of a movement that is, but they sure are being more vocal. and pushing things around. And it's interesting. It's interesting to watch. And the candidates, most notably probably in this Republican primary for state auditor, Seth Morgan and Dave Yost, the Tea Party movement, I think, is playing a big role in that race.
Absolutely fascinating.
Well, let's talk about that race because you brought it up earlier. It is probably the most divisive or the most interesting. We've already figured out there's really not a lot going on in the governor's race right now because they're not saying a whole lot. But what's going on with that?
So you have Seth Morgan, who's a state rep, and he is he announced his candidacy back when I believe Mary Taylor was still going to run. Then she
He waited till when she joined
the
Kasich ticket.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was on that day or whatever. He was ready to go very quickly. Dave Yost was running for another office. The Republican Party asked him to move into the auditor race against Seth Morgan. Seth Morgan is a Tea Party darling. He was the first one that this newly formed Tea Party PAC has endorsed. He's all over the state on this. And he is trying to – he brought up the fact that Dave Yost has on his campaign team someone from the former Dieters scandal days last week.
Former Secretary of State.
Or Treasurer.
State Treasurer.
State yep. Treasurer. And it just kind of blew up. It got to be a bunch of people, including Dieters himself, got on online and said, this is a smear campaign and you don't know anything about running campaigns if you think this is relevant. Then shortly thereafter, Ken Blackwell, who you might think would be a Tea Party darling, came out and endorsed Yost. And so I think that, Ken Blackwell, the gubernatorial candidate from 06, is trying to say, I'm with the party. Even though they didn't pick me to run the RNC, the party is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. But, Dave Yost, what's gotten – the Tea Party actually supported Dave Yost when he was running in the attorney general's race because they didn't like the other Republican in that race, Mike DeWine. But now they're angry because Yost slid over.
Right.
So both candidates that they like – are in the same race. Now they're endorsing, it looks like. I mean, they're not supposed to really be that organized. So when I say they're endorsing, I'm not really sure who is endorsing because the whole idea of the Tea Party is they don't have this, real organized setup. But many of them are backing Seth Morgan in that race. And it's been interesting and it's turned into a real slugfest, a lot of things that Julie mentioned, who's working for who. And
a lot of that has more to do with not the individual's political principles and what they believe in fiscally in terms of fiscal public policy, but by virtue of the fact that Dave Yost backed off from the attorney general's race and followed the lead of Democrat or the Republican Party in doing so.
Right. And meanwhile, what's interesting is what interested me about Morgan attempting to bring up an old Republican scandal, a very old one by political terms, like 2004 or something.
That's the Dieters scandal.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that, that's not good for the Republicans. And the Democrats are sitting back not having to say a word or spend a dime. And, these guys are going at it.
Well, all things being equal, Tea Party members, if you want to call them members, are they're a splinter group of the Republican
sure.
Party and of that Republican base. It's never good.
Sure. Right. Although I think that they are more and more in this state are showing themselves to be your typical Ohio independent. Some people in Northeast Ohio, for example, are loving Traficant right now as a Democrat and maybe voted for Clinton, voted for Bush. Now they don't know what they want to do. And so, I think in every region of the state, it's got that independence to it.
Okay.
Seems to. But they were out protesting when the Ohio Republican Party met to endorse Dave Yost. I was inside the meeting and you could hear them very loudly outside protesting the Republican Party. It was interesting.
In general, some of these folks are independents, but I mean, let's face it, they are on the right of the political spectrum. So in general, they would tend to be Republicans, although I understand there are some independents and Democrats
sure.
among them. But this just shows the basic dilemma of anybody who's on the substantial right or the substantial left. We've had the same battle in the Democrats. Sometimes people on the left of the Democratic Party say, oh, the party is too centrist and we need to push it to the left. Well, yeah, you can push it to the left. That's fine. And you may even win the primary. But then you put your party in danger because your party is perceived as perhaps too far from the political center where all the votes are. And it's the same thing with this Tea Party, folks. These Democrats, maybe they're loving it. They're loving not only the split, but in the Republican Party, but they're loving the fact that these Tea Partiers may push the Republican Party so far to the right that their candidates will be perceived as too far from the center. And it'll be easier for the Democrats to win the general election.
You guys may have noticed, I think it's kind of funny, I don't know how the viewers will think, but I get press releases, I know you all do, from the Democratic Party about the auditor's race. And they don't have a candidate in the primary.
Yeah, sure.
But they send press releases, and also I'll read them, and then all of a sudden I'll realize who it's from, and I'm just like, "What are you? What?"
Oh yeah, what we're seeing a lot is the deadly. In case you missed the emails, we get those a lot.
Yeah. Well, one thing they're sending us, the Democrats are sending this, the thing about Rob Portman, the U.S. Senate candidate for the Republicans. And, you know, he was at some rallies where some people introduced him and the folks who introduced him were hinting that they believed that the president was not really born in the United States. And, you know, the birther,
right,
or the whole birther thing. So then the Democrats leap on this and say, OK, Rob Portman, do you disavow these people who said that the president was not born in the United States and can't really hold the office? And, you know, again, just egging on the Republicans, trying to show any kind of a split.
We're going to take another short break. My guests are Bill Cohen from Ohio Public Radio, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch, and Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Try to keep those emails tight. We only have so much time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Capital City Radio.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kopp. This week, Jim.
And this is Capital City Radio.
I would rather go blind, boy.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about predatory practices by debt collectors, consumer rights, and a program to provide legal guidance to consumers in Franklin County. That discussion begins at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 46 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:39. Sunshine today and a nice Tuesday afternoon, a high in the mid-50s. Clear skies tonight, a low of 35 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 60 degrees. And more sunshine on Thursday with a high of 61. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us and good morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about State House news with Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Kathy Kandisky, a State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Julie Carr-Smythe, State House Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Thanks for being with us again, guys. Let's talk about the Ohio Workers' Compensation Council, which I had completely forgotten about until a recent story by Julie Carr-Smythe. What's the deal, Julie?
Well, it's an obscure little, you might think, legislative advisory board.
Ironically obscure.
Right. Ironically obscure. After the CoinGate scandal, really summarizing this quickly, the legislature decided that they should have an entity, much like we have one over the pensions, that would watch as legislation is introduced and see if it's good or bad from the perspective of our workers' compensation fund, which is the largest publicly run insurance fund for injured workers in America. So they appointed this board. But, of course, there were some growing pains, and all that was to be expected. All of a sudden, We find out just a few weeks ago that the executive director had fired her entire staff, which was three people, two lawyers and an executive assistant. And they came back and said, wow, we tried to get a settlement agreement with her rather than being fired because she's been harassing us, religiously discriminating against us, and so forth, and retaliating and everything. She is a member of the Vineyard Church in Columbus. Mm-hmm. She is an evangelical, has written a book and this sort of thing, and they allege that she was having prayers during office time, was providing them with God at Work CDs that they were supposed to listen to, and other things. So it kind of blew up and it kind of fizzled because this panel of legislators and others who are supposed to oversee it were doing nothing. And last night they met. For the first time since all this had come to light. Okay. And met behind closed doors for 3 hours, promptly came out and said, we're going to create a new 5-person personnel committee, subcommittee of this little committee, which is a little tiny version of the legislature.
The solution.
And they adjourned. And everybody was standing around going, well, what happened? What happened? And if you would try to say to them, I'm sorry, is this 5-member panel going to then resolve the issue between the director, who's still employed, and the workers who were in the audience who were fired?
And who else is running the office? Who's answering the phone?
Just her. And we've heard maybe she has a part-time helper of some kind. But basically, she's running it by herself. In the hallways at the State House, the lawmakers I was running into during my 3 hours, you know, there's a lot of rumblings. Let's just get rid of it. One of the things that happened was it was supposed to provide some insight to lawmakers about the health of the fund. And instead, somewhere along the line, decided we should not provide recommendations. We should just provide technical assistance. Well, they've spent $1 million on an office and furniture and salaries for all these lawyers. And the Legislative Service Commission already provides neutral advice. They were supposed to come in and say yay or nay. Our recommendation is you vote yes on this bill because this would be fine for the workers' comp fund. Our advice is this is a bad bill. You need to reject it. And this is what the cousin agency, the Retirement Study Council, does for the pensions and has for years and years.
Well, what you say when you're talking, you say the rumblings in the State House, but what do lawmakers say about this? Were the lawmakers on the panel frustrated that they hadn't really done anything? That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And Dan Dodd, who's the chairman of the House Insurance Committee, is planning to have some hearings to discuss overall operations. I think he will probably be restricted to not talking about this personnel matter, which is actually, as we were just saying, the juiciest and most interesting piece of this.
As usual.
But because they had to meet an executive session and it's personnel and these employees have threatened legal action, all that stuff puts it sort of in the confidential
realm. Are they talking?
The employees?
Yes.
They did, however, write these really lengthy letters to members of the panel, which were public records that we saw, that basically explained everything that they felt that they had gone through.
Now, we mentioned the word ironically earlier because, of course, this was the biggest scandal to hit the State House in a gazillion years. I mean, it really took down the Republican Party for a while. You said in one of your leads, after a sweeping scandal nearly 5 years ago that cost the state insurance fund for injured workers $300 million because of investments in Beanie Babies, rare coins, and other risky assets, Ohio beefed up oversight and created a panel to help lawmakers look out for the health of the fund. And all we've gotten out of that panel is what?
We have gotten one bill analysis, and it was on an important bill. It has to do with this group rating system, which are discounts if you belong to a group, say a chamber or some association, you can get a discount on your workers' comp insurance, and that's an expensive thing for a business. But they provided an analysis without a recommendation. So they didn't say vote yes, vote no on the bill. And it's cost about $1 million. Now we have an office that's in chaos and three fired people who may be suing the state for a great amount of money.
Kathy, you just wrote about the Race to the Top grants and then told
Federal
us today. I think today you wrote that the governor is in going to Washington today to make a pitch.
They should be presenting right now. It was this morning that governor was going to lead Ohio's team of presenters to make an in-person pitch for a share of the, I think it's $4.3 billion Race to the Top funds. They're going to be awarded to certain states. Ohio's one of 16 finalists now. The state's looking for about $409 million. This would be really important money.
What would it be used
for? It would be used to implement a lot of the governor's education plan that was passed in the budget, but they haven't been able to implement a lot because there's not a lot of money. It would go to things like teacher training, providing better data on student achievement and stuff that teachers can use to kind of drill down and see what kids need, improving poor performing schools, all those kind of things. It's Ohio wasn't expected to be a finalist.
It was a finalist out of how many original?
41 okay. states, District of Columbia, applied for the money. 16 finalists were named. Ohio's one of them. A handful. Education Secretary Duncan says there's only going to be a few winners in this first round. All the finalists are in Washington this week, and they will learn April 1st if they were successful. If Ohio is not successful, they can reapply for the second round funds in June, and those will be awarded later this year. So it's not all over if we don't get this first round.
And let's turn to slot machines. Bill, there's hearings on slot machines at the racetracks now. There's a separate – they're hearing – what are they talking about at the State House about this now?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, slot machines, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they're bringing back slot machines at the racetrack. Now, remember, the governor and legislators last year passed a slots at the tracks plan.
Right.
And then it was put on hold by the Ohio Supreme Court, who said, wait a minute, this should be subject to a referendum if some group can collect enough petition signatures. And it appears that this group has collected enough petition signatures. So we're going to supposed to be voting on that in November, up or down. Do you want slots at the tracks? But then on a separate track, legislators are pushing another bill for slots at the tracks. And I was saying, well now what's this all about? And they said, well, one reason we want to push this, said the sponsor, is because even if the voters reject the plan that we passed last year on slots at the tracks, this new plan could still go into effect.
So we
wouldn't that go against the spirit of what the voters would be telling you? And Lou Blessing, the state representative, the sponsor of this bill, said no. So okay. He wants to push again slots at the tracks, and there's some other things people want to add to it. Some bar owners and
bowling alleys.
Well, let us in on it. They tried that last year; they didn't get anywhere. They're trying again. Add us so that not only will we have slots at the seven racetracks, we'll have it at hundreds and thousands of local taverns.
Is the timing at all connected to the fact that Penn National Gaming just bought Beulah Park and has said that it really will only be a doable operation if they can have slots there?
I don't think so. I think that basically Penn and Mountaineer, the other big mm-hmm. gambling companies are just trying to hedge their bets, if you will. I think they want to own the competition or, monopolize as best they can the state. I mean, based on the fact that they switch positions on whether they're for or against casino gambling, depending on the year. And so I think that was just coincidental. But, you know, the horse tracks have been saying for a long time.
And Lou Blessing has been supportive of slots for a long time.
Yeah.
I think it's more indicative of just the fact now that we have voted up these casinos that the likelihood of expanding gambling in Ohio is a lot greater. And these folks see the opportunity to invest and be ready when things happen and they're able to, you know, turn a profit here. And buying that track was probably nothing for them.
Dropping the bucket.
Right. And I think that it looks to them like, well, the dam has been burst here and just go for it.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to call and talk with our panelists. Henry, you're on the air. You want to backtrack a little bit and talk about what history says about
the
influence of ordinary people.
There was a fellow who called up
Mike.
Before and he said ordinary people never get the power to vote or to run political parties.
Or at least they don't have it now.
If he knew history, he would know from the time the country was formed, The ordinary person never had political power. The people who went to the First and Second Continental Congress were not ordinary people. They were the rich landowners. And you can just go on through history and find that. And that's the way it is.
That's
and
the way it is.
And most of all, look up a dictionary definition of fascism, because it's not what he thinks it is. And that's about all I have to say.
All right, Henry, well, tell us what the dictionary definition of fascism is.
A strong central government that does not allow opposition. It controls the government. It controls industry. It controls everything.
Okay. Thanks, Henry, for your call.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Okay. Now, there was a bill that I read about that was getting some action in both chambers, the DNA bill. Am I wrong about that? Does anybody know anything? You're all looking at each other. Okay, then let's move on. What about the land
bank? Let me just say that, we have had DNA testing.
This proves to my listeners that I do not run these questions by my panelists in advance. Yes,
Bill. We don't know all the details, but we have had some DNA testing the last few years. It's really helped to confirm that some people are guilty, and once in a while have confirmed that, hey, this guy's not guilty, even though he's been in prison for years. So they're just trying to expand that and make it more efficient and allow more people to use it. And I think that's what this latest bill is. And Democrats and Republicans alike are tending to support it. I think the prosecutors and the cops had some problems with it earlier. Mm-hmm. But I think those problems are being worked out. And I think it appears that it's going to be a bipartisan vote in favor of this expansion.
Yeah, and then the number of these cases that we see, you know, on death row, exonerations for using DNA evidence is growing. It's not, you know, a complete indictment of the system. But I think that you'll see if you look that there are few people. I just heard this morning someone being sentenced to, you know, 160 years in prison or something in lieu of the death penalty. And that is happening more and more. We're seeing fewer death penalty because of the skepticism about DNA. So that's sort of a nonpartisan issue.
When it comes to DNA, though, the bottom line is the bottom line. They don't have the funding they need to do all the DNA testing that's out there. They don't even can't even get through the banks of DNA that they have now to test.
Right. And so, you know, here again, when we were talking about the budget, mm-hmm. it's sort of like, you know, they may like this in theory, but the question is whether it would come along with some financial requirements. And if it does, then it'll be difficult for it to have any teeth unless they attach some money to it.
What about that bill that would ban text messaging while driving?
Never.
Never? It'll never happen?
Anything that deals with cell phones and...
Something that lawmakers use.
Something that lawmakers use every day as they drive. You know, I just think it's hard. It's hard. Got an uphill battle. But
they've done it in 16 or 17 other states.
They have. And Oprah's even advocating for it now. But as much as people think it's a good idea, people don't want to not be able to do it. I mean, it's just kind of one of those strange issues. I think it's hard. I mean, it's hard to argue against a bill like that.
I think it's hard to text while you're driving. I can't do it. Forget about wanting to do it.
Well, and it's just an absolute constant. I used to cover transportation for many years, and, you know, it's always something. Sleeping while driving. I don't know. We never have gotten to probably the worst one, which is eating fast food while driving.
Yeah.
I mean, how many things do you juggle when you're eating while driving?
No comment.
But it's never come up. As Kathy said, these things, when they're popular, there's always a bill. There's always a push to ban it. And then it kind of goes away. And, you know, the technology is moving so fast now that we won't need to text in just a couple years anyway. We'll probably
it'll be voice.
It'll blink.
It'll blink.
What you're talking about, though, is one reason I think that the Public Safety Department, who we think are the experts on public safety, and we keep going to them every few years, well, do you endorse this plan? Isn't it a distraction? Yes, it's a distraction, they say, but there's 100 other distractions, putting on your makeup, eating a Big Mac. You can't put all those into one bill, and so they've never endorsed specifically this kind of bill. Not that, and of course they say we are against people texting. We don't want people texting, but they never quite endorse this bill.
You know, one of the problems with texting is, though, of course, is that is the young people. and new drivers texting and that sort of thing. And that seems to be what a lot of the thrust is on, you know, around the country.
Well, but it's interesting. I mean, we do have in Ohio a seatbelt law. Now, that protects you, not necessarily other drivers. It protects you from being injured should you be in an accident. But, this is something that would protect other people. I don't know. It's hard for me to fathom that it's not going to move through, but I don't think it will.
Well, and in Columbus, where they're looking at a cell phone ban, I think some of the testimony was pretty interesting when you're talking about, why not just ban distracted driving? And if a trooper sees somebody with anything that appears to be distracting them, then...
Like a baby in the car?
Like a baby screaming?
But, you know, don't get me started on that.
But if the driver is not driving erratically, which right. is really what you're trying to avoid, it's right. just pretty hard to fashion a law that says if you have a potentially distracting
right.
Thing in the car and it really hasn't distracted you yet and caused you to drive right. erratically, it's pretty hard to fashion.
When texting distracts, it's almost split second. You're either going to survive the distraction or you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. Jonathan, you're on the air. You want to talk about insurance companies and text messaging while driving.
Yeah, I hear that Allstate is going to now consider charging considerably more higher premiums for people who are in text accidents because they equate texting with something equivalent to drinking 4 beers while driving.
That's
well, there you go. That's the way the free market, responds to a threat. And and actually, the insurance industry is behind a lot of the bills that we see on the safety issue.
You might also see it, with your companies, corporations that, provide automobiles to their employees. You might see it through small municipalities, you mentioned.
Well, there have been that Bexley has one now and others do. Jonathan, do you support a ban on text messaging?
I would say generally I'm for individualism and private rights, but on the other hand, I'm driving as we speak, and I'm just talking, and it's not terribly easy. So maybe, yeah.
Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Pull over.
You're not pinning this one on me, Jonathan. Thanks for your call. we only have a minute left, and that's not enough time for us to talk about anything else, I don't think. I want to just thank my guest today, Bill Cohen from Ohio Public Radio. Thanks for being with us, Bill.
It's been a pleasure.
And Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy, thanks for being.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. Glad you could make it.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Okay. And to the listeners, thanks for being here as well. Thanks for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Mm-hmm.